ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In the course of my travels, I've been recording nature soundscapes with the aim of helping you, Australia, to relax. And in this particular overnight recording, there was this one duck that just kept screaming its guts out. Anyway, don't worry, I've selected only the best, most relaxing soundscapes that absolutely do not feature this duck. Find Nature Sounds by Anne Jones wherever you get your podcasts and on the ABC Listen app.
From love?
For her, she says that in many ways, mortals are so much luckier than gods because everything they experience is at a heightened point. Their joys, their griefs, you know, and the depths of their loves are so much deeper than what we can ever have.
To sex.
My dad says this thing where he says Greeks invented sex and Romans invented it with women. which I think is true.
To death.
Some of us may be fools, so we'll never meet Athena. You know, some may not have a great love life, so we're not going to see much of Aphrodite. But for sure, we're all going to meet Hades. And so, and yet he's notably unworshipped.
Greek mythology has it all and more. Gods, goddesses, heroes, monsters, quests and odysseys. Plenty of violence. And as Christopher Nolan's box office smash retelling of the Greek epic, The Odyssey, suggests, these stories will never die, but they might be retold. And today on Big Ideas, three superstar writers with their own mythical retellings. With Big Thinkers at the best live events on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, I'm Natasha Mitchell, welcome. And at the Melbourne Writers' Festival, we're joined by Booker Prize-winning author of The Life of Pi, Jan Martel, whose new book, Son of Nobody, is a contemporary reimagining of Homer's The Iliad, which happens to be the prequel to The Odyssey in the Trojan War trilogy. The Irish Kashmiri best-selling poet, playwright, actor and popular Instagrammer Nikita Gill's latest book, Hecate, The Witch, is described as a fiercely feminist reimagining of an enigmatic Greek goddess. And the non-binary trans-Cypriot Australian writer and actor, Zoe Taraki's first book, Eros, is a collection of Greek myths retold through a queer lens. And they're joined today by host, editor of the Australian Literary Journal, Griffith Review, Carity Culver.
The ancient myths have such a stronghold over our imaginations, and they pass universal themes of belonging, love, and grief as well. So, Jan, I am starting with you. Your novel, Son of Nobody, is a beautifully poignant and it's a very structurally inventive story within a story. It's about a Canadian classic scholar called Harlow Don. And during a scholarship year at Oxford University, he is meant to be translating various very dry bureaucratic parchments from ancient Greek. And he discovers these fragments of an epic poem that offers a different account of the Trojan War. It's one that centres on a common soldier. Now, the Iliad, which is the most famous account of that war, looms large in this book, as we heard from my next question for Jan. Spoiler alert. Tell us about your first encounter with the Iliad and how that led you to imagine a new way of telling that story.
Well, I came to the Iliad quite late. I grew up on the Greek myths, reading retellings of them. Roger Lancelin Green, Edith Hamilton, Robert Graves. I always read the retellings, but I never actually read original material until just a few years ago when my partner suggested that because I was between books, she said, why don't you read this great new translation? Not quite so new now, but it was just a few years ago, called by an American poet named Stephen Mitchell. And it's a very lean translation. He's cut away any excess that's been added over the ages, and he's also pared away stuff that is endlessly repetitive in the original. All those epithets, these repeated modifiers, swift running, horse taming, wine dark, all these things that are incessantly repeated, he cut out. Anyway, it's a very lean, propulsive translation of the Iliad. So I read it, and it wasn't what I expected. And lots of books you read aren't what you expected, but what's nice about myth, and I think it's central to what we'll be talking about today, what's nice about myths is that they're endlessly plastic, elastic. There's no accountability to anything, so they invite you to play with them. You know, you can't play quite so much with history, or if you do, you're doing it a very knowing way where people will say, this is what really happened and this is how you're playing with it. So there's still, you know, the retelling of a historical event is still tethered to what we know happened. Whereas with myth, it's not the case at all. You can really do what you want, so it's, and it makes it, therefore, you can personalize it a lot. So that's what happened with me with reading the Iliad there. I saw elements there that I had not expected. So, for example, everyone in the Iliad who speaks is a blue blood of one sort or another, either a god or a king or a queen. And only one commoner speaks, only one. And of all the people to speak in the Iliad, he, in a sense, is the one who makes the most sense, because his name is Thersites, and he appears in Book 2. He questions the war. He rails against Agamemnon, saying, why are we here? What do we have to gain from being here? We get nothing, you get everything. And that voice, to me, makes complete sense as a person from the 21st century. Why would these people fight for 10 years for nothing when all the kings get everything, they get nothing, and yet he's promptly beaten down? So, you know, I took Thersites and said, oh, let me imagine someone like him, not Thersites himself, although he's a character in Son of Nobody, but someone like that. And so these myths allow you to do that, to take them and malign them and turn them around and retell something that you want for your own purpose. So that was my reaction to the Iliad, to do that, and the result is Son of Nobody.
Mm. And there are these many different accounts of the Trojan War over the centuries that have sought to give us greater insight into the stories of the Iliad's female characters, even going back as far, I think, as Euripides. So I love that you have a more of a class lens that you use in this novel. Nikita, your book also takes figures that have typically been relegated to the margins and brings them into the spotlight. So your verse novel, Hecate, is a lyrical, compelling reimagining of the life of this goddess. She is one of the lesser known Greek goddesses, but she is the goddess of witchcraft and necromancy, which I think means actually she should be everybody's favourite. Mm-hmm. And this book is the first in a planned quartet of verse novels. So each one is going to reimagine the life of another goddess who has been sort of unfairly overshadowed by A-listers like Aphrodite. So tell us why Hecate has been neglected and what drew you to tell her story.
So I always found the figure of Hecate fascinating. When I heard about her, there's a mention of her in Macbeth with the beautiful gender-bending witches in Macbeth who were so fascinating and so entertaining, I would say. And I find like Hecate, this kind of figure that has been in the liminal spaces. You know, she's the goddess who helped Zeus defeat the giants during the giant Nomache. There isn't a whole lot known about her. The source material is quite sparse on her. And I realized that in general, the source material is very sparse on all of the Titans, but there's a lot to be said about the Olympians, like you said, like they are the A-listers. Whoever does the PR for dogs does the PR for the Olympians. Everyone knows about them. But the Titans, much like cats, don't get very good PR. So, so I was like, I found four goddesses who I thought were absolutely fascinating. And I thought I would start with Hecate because she is not just the goddess of what is called modern day witchcraft and necromancy, which is the gift of bringing the dead back to life, but she's also the goddess of liminal spaces and she's the goddess of the crossroads and the keys. So during something called the Depnon, which is the night of the dark moon, Hecate basically raises the dead and they then roam the earth. And if you leave a feast out for them, this is what the ancients believed, if you leave a feast out for them, the dead will bless you and your home. And I thought that was such a beautiful little superstition story about her. And that's where the story really came to me. This goddess bringing the dead and bringing them to earth or bringing them back to life and making them roam the earth. So the story came to me that way. But then what really annoyed me was that, okay, I have beef with Hesiod. Hesiod, if you don't know, is the insta-poet of ancient Greece. He's written two very short poems. One of them is called Theogony, which we use pretty much as the genesis of the Greek gods. And the other one is Work in Days, which is basically him telling his brother that his brother's a very, very lazy SOB. Which, you know, I have a younger brother, I get it. But Hesiod doesn't like women and he doesn't like brothers, which makes me think that his brother ran away with his wife. Understandably,
Anyway, so basically Hesiod is not very kind to women in Theogony, none of the goddesses, other than one goddess, Hecate. She is the only one that he writes a page and a half litany of like how amazing she is. And the core basis of her amazingness is that she betrays her Titan family to stand with the Olympians. Now, as somebody who, you know, I'm Northern Irish and Kashmiri, I know what happens to women who are on the losing side of a war. And I simply did not see Hecate doing that to her family, her mother specifically, Asteria, especially because she's the goddess of night oracles and the falling stars, also quite an occult goddess. So I questioned that, and from that question, Hecate was born, the book.
And she sits, that the story that you weave, which I think goes to what Jan was saying earlier about the sort of pliability of these myths, the story that you weave shows us all of these interesting choices that she makes across the course of her life and really gives us insight into the evolution of this quite remarkable figure. And of course, she sits very much outside these sort of patriarchal notions. And Zoe, your book very much sits inside this space as well. So your collection, which is called Eros, is a wildly entertaining and original retelling of myths from Ovid's Metamorphoses. And your versions of these stories, which include the doomed flight of Icarus and the transformation of Hermaphroditus, illuminate the inherent queerness and transness of these tales. And the work is also inspired by your own Cretan heritage. So I wanted to ask how you see the intersections between Cretan history and trans history and how that led you to write this book.
Yeah, I mean, they're actually far more linked than I ever thought possible, in that I think, as is evident in the book, nature is such a huge part of both of those identities. I think trans people feel such an affinity with nature because, you know, in these times where our existence is being scrutinized and questioned, and how the very fact that we have ever been here before is completely disregarded, nature sort of welcomes transness because nature depends on transness. Like, nature has depended on transness for the survival of its species, for life on Earth, for billions of years. You know, there's like trans fungi and trans fish. So I think trans people feel so welcome in nature. And Crete, where my family's from, and nature are also inseparable. And so, yeah, I found this strange link between the two of them. And it became all the more evident to me when, you know, I think a thing that a lot of trans people get told is that we are a new phenomenon and a contemporary threat to society. But then when I was going through Ovid's Metamorphoses and sort of looking for stories, I mean, the queerness was everywhere. I didn't have to. My dad says this thing where he says Greeks invented sex and Romans invented it with women, which I think is true. So the queerness I didn't have to look very hard for, but the transness, I was sort of, you know, you kind of have to sift through a whole lot of bullshit to find it. But there it was in plain sight in the story of Iphis and Ianthe, which is a lesser known story. But there is this trans boy in Crete, where my family is from, 7,000 years ago. And Isis, because Crete is like, I don't know, geographically, it's in between mainland Greece and Egypt and Libya. And Egyptian mythology comes into Cretan mythology a lot more than the mainland. And Isis, the Egyptian goddess, travels over the water to Crete to grant this boy his manhood, which was just like the, it was almost like too obvious. I was like, wow, we really, like, I can literally trace myself 7,000 years ago. So yeah, it was a real nice line of argument against anyone who believes otherwise. Yeah.
And that nature connection that you talk about, you evoke so beautifully. There's a real sort of earthiness to the writing. There's a real sense of visceral sort of connection to the land. So home is a major theme of all of these books, but you all evoke that theme in really, really different ways. So the Soad, Jan, is this epic poem that features in Son of Nobody. You have these parallel narratives. You have the poem at the top half of the page, and then you have Harlow's narrative, his interpretation of the poem, running below it. So in the Soad, Psoas, the hero of this epic poem, he's been away from his family for 10 long years, and he's fighting a war that he knows he ultimately isn't going to be remembered for, as you alluded to earlier. And Harlow too, he's away from home for most of the book. But unlike Psoas, Harlow has a choice. So he doesn't have to leave his family and his beloved daughter Helen in particular. He doesn't have to go to Oxford to take up this scholarship. Why does he go, and how does that affect his relationship with his wife and his child?
Well, I think there it asks the question of ambition. You're right, he doesn't have to go. Just as in a sense Psoas doesn't have to go for Troy, but you are promised, as young British boys were promised in August of 1914, go over for this quick war, you'll win quickly, just a summer jaunt, and you'll be back, and you'll be the better for it. You know, there's something very alluring to quick rewards. So I think Psoas goes over, as he says at one point in the poem, he doesn't go for glory, he goes for loot. He lives an impoverished existence as a Greek peasant, so he figures that if he goes to Troy and it's a quick little summer war to punish the Trojans, and he'll come back with loot. So I think there's that. And for Harlow, I mean, who wouldn't, given a fellowship to Oxford, not go to Oxford? So it seems obvious that he would go there. And once he's there, yeah, he finds the wisps of this lost Trojan War tradition, and he stays. So I suppose, like Agamemnon, I try to draw an explicit parallel between Agamemnon and Psoas. He is blinded by ambition. He makes mistakes from the outside seem foolish, but from the inside have their own inner logic. I mean, the Iliad to me is a poem about, yes, life's brevity and life's cruelty, but also about failed anger management. Agamemnon, it's all about these angry these angry men who fail to realize the consequences of anger and fail to harness it. And in the same way with Harlow, I think he goes too far. And the same thing with Psoas in the poem. Psoas is imbued with, maybe at one point might be perceived as righteous anger, but then he goes too far. As most revolutions go too far. You have to, anger is not itself a negative emotion, but you have to learn how to harness it. And in the Iliad, there's a failure for that. But Agamemnon, when he is angry, that's a curious thing about anger. It's a very self-justifying emotion. Usually when we feel anger, we feel that it's right for us to be angry, because after all, we're reasonable people. So if we're angry, it must be for a good reason, and therefore let's keep on being angry. It's only from the outside that we can see the limitations of that thinking. So I think it's the same thing for Harlow. From the outside, his decision to stay at Oxford seems foolish, but from the inside, he's making the same mistake as Agamemnon making, of saying, it's worth it, I must stay here, I must accomplish what I come here to accomplish. In Agamemnon's case, defeat Troy, and in Harlow's case, to complete this poem that he's discovered.
And it leads to really these two types of warfare in the book. You have this sort of marital warfare that's unfolding across the oceans between Harlow and his wife, and then of course you have the military war that's unfolding in the world of the Psoad.
On Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, you're with me, Natasha Mitchell, and we're joined by the Booker Prize-winning Canadian author Yann Martel, whose new book, Son of Nobody, reimagines Homer's The Iliad. He's with Irish Indian best-selling poet Nikita Gill, whose book Hecate the Witch is a feminist story of the Greek goddess Hecate, and Australian actor and author Zoe Tarakis, whose first book Eros is described as a sexy modern take on ancient Greek myths. From the stage of the Melbourne Writers' Festival in Naarm, The Odyssey, now in cinemas. On Big Ideas, we're looking at other mythical retellings and why these stories endure. The host is editor of Griffith Review, Carity Culver.
Nikita, your book also evokes the emotional consequences of war and displacement and the connection of those things to the idea of home. So Hecate is a war refugee when she is a child. This war breaks out between the old gods, the Titans, and the new gods, the Olympians. And her mother, Asteria, takes her to the only place that she knows Hecate will be safe, which is the underworld. And so she has this really unusual upbringing, surrounded by bones and ghosts and Styx, who is the goddess of the river that brings the dead into the underworld and who's also Hecate's aunt, becomes a sort of mother figure. Well, she's not terribly maternal, but she is a fascinating character. How does the underworld as a place and Hecate's displacement from her family and from her home change her?
So I think the all-encompassing loss of being a refugee is not something we normally associate with a goddess, and especially not in Greek mythology. You know, you've got these awesome figures, and, you know, for better or worse, when you're a god, you're immortal, which means your parents are with you forever. For better or worse, you know, Zeus is not exactly dad of the year. The only good thing he does is raise all his children gay. But just saying. But it's one of those things where Hecate, unfortunately, both her parents become prisoners of war, and she loses both of them pretty much with immediacy. And my grandfather was a refugee, and his experience of what that was played a very big role in when I was writing Hecate, because her mother crosses the water illegally with her. She isn't supposed to be in the underworld, and she has to barter and negotiate with Hades, who was on the opposite side of the war to her. And the way she has to negotiate and basically say, please take my child, she leaves her child with strangers and hopes for the best. And that experience in itself is so formative to Hecate, because later on, when Demeter loses Persephone, or who is Kore then, to Hades, Hecate is so motivated to help Demeter, because she says there's a legacy in this family of ripping mothers and daughters apart from each other, and I can't allow it to happen, not whilst I exist. And so that becomes a core motive for her, and that trauma, she's able to take that and turn that into something completely different. And I think that's such a powerful part of the story of breaking a generational curse within a family.
Yeah, it's a story of her sort of confronting her trauma. And particularly in the first couple of sections of the book, she discovers more about herself, and she discovers these secrets about her family, and they begin to really shape her sense of who she is. So there's a similar sort of sense of becoming in the stories in Eros, and I suppose that idea of feeling at home in your own skin. And that's particularly in the case in the opening story, which you alluded to before, Iphis and Ianthe. So I think characters in this story represent both risk and refuge. You talked a little bit earlier about the role of Isis in this tale, but what about Iphis's birth and the lengths to which his mother goes to protect him from the rage of his father? Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, not to keep bringing it to contemporary politics, but I guess also that's why myth is so amazing, is because it is unfortunately ever applicable. But, you know, I think we see so much of the time queer people, but specifically trans people, pitted against women. And it's very sad, because it just really doesn't have to be that way, obviously. But I felt really strongly about having women and trans people in that myth be such a strong union. And so in that myth particularly, like, it really is Iphis's mother who holds him together and protects him and sort of keeps his gender sacred, really. And then, you know, when Ianthe comes along, it's the same thing. And so, at the end of that story, the two women walk ahead of him once he is in his body as it was meant to be. And they just laugh under this, you know, setting sun. And you just get this, I don't know, I kind of wanted to make the women the heroes of his story, because that is, I mean, fortunately, in my experience, that has been the case. Like, my mum has been one of the great heroes of my gender story, I suppose. But yeah, in terms of, I think, bringing it back to home as well, I think there is something in Greek mythology that is so separate and so removed from us, but that was something that later in the book I felt really strongly about, is I think usually we have myth on one plane and reality on another. And I just don't think that's how it is. I really think myth and reality exist on the same plane, and myths are playing out in real time all of the time. And we only have to look at the politicians in our world to see that very clearly. There are monsters among us. But yeah, I felt that that was really important as well, to have myth not as this sort of abject, abstract thing that exists over there, but as something that, of course, exists here on this soil too, and constantly.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why, again, it goes back to that enduring power of myth and why we keep returning to it. Love is a big theme of all of these books as well. But, of course, in the immortal words of Pat Benatar, love is a battleground. And you're often juxtaposing love with warfare or with death, with hubris, whether it's literal or emotional, just as ancient myths often presented love as an emotion that could be sort of destructive or violent. Jan, you've talked a little bit about that sense of anger, and I suppose anger is very closely tied to love because they're both emotions that are really motivated by passion and by desire, and that is a part of Psoas's story, it's part of Harlow's story. I just want to ask you about a beautiful moment towards the end of the Psoad, where Psoas has a remarkable encounter with Hades, the god of death. Harlow describes Hades as, quote, notably unworshipped. Why worship a god who has nothing to offer? End quote. I love this part of the book because Hades is very fatalistic. He's quite avuncular. He even clears his throat before he talks to Psoas, which I thought was a beautiful detail. What does that exchange between the two of them tell us about the ancient Greek view of death and our contemporary Western understanding of it, and I suppose how that connects to love?
Well, I find of all the Greek gods, Hades particularly interesting because the gods above ground quite clearly represent certain human emotions or certain human characteristics. So, you know, Athena represents wisdom and, you know, personifies wisdom in a very interesting way. Aphrodite, lust, desire, etc. They all sort of seem to corner some parcel of who we are as human beings. Some quite explicitly, like Athena with her wisdom. I'm not sure what Poseidon particularly represents in terms of our characteristics necessarily, but there's something very vivid and colorful about all the Greek gods, and they're all well known, as Nikita was saying, they're all exceedingly well known. They are the A-listers of Greek mythology. We all know them. The one who's sort of slightly neglected, but if you think of it, is the one we're all going to meet at one point, Hades, because of our mortal condition, the one god for sure we will meet. Some of us may be fools, so we'll never meet Athena. You know, some may not have a great love life, so we're not going to see much of Aphrodite. But for sure, we're all going to meet Hades. And yet he's notably unworshipped. And in the ancient traditions, unlike all the other gods, he had no children and is notably faithful to his wife. He doesn't whore around the way Zeus does. No raping involved in the life of Hades. He's a very, very sober god. And the thing that I find particularly interesting about Hades is that he's the only Greek god that migrates to the Christian cosmos. He's the only Greek god who's mentioned in the Gospels and in the Bible. None of the other ones are mentioned, and I thought it was just kind of intriguing because usually I think of religions as being quite exclusive and they don't usually talk to each other. We're not used to the idea of Krishna talking to Jesus. It just doesn't, there's no myths about that, even though their personalities are quite similar. The loving kindness of Jesus is echoed very much in the loving kindness of Krishna. But religions don't usually talk to each other, but here's an instance of Jesus, even Jesus mentions Hades. And so I thought that was very peculiar, that of all the possible gods that could migrate to Christianity, the only one is the god of death. So yeah, there is that scene where Psoas meets the god of death and they have this conversation, and indeed he is very avuncular, very petit bourgeois, goes on a little walk because he misses his wife. And so, but yeah, I thought he was a god that I found most interesting because he's the most sober of the Greek gods. He's not a god of excess. He's not a god of anger. He's a very tempered god. In the Iliad, the gods it's a very busy epic, the Iliad, for the gods. They're incessantly arguing. It's like they're binge-watching a Netflix series and they're all arguing about it. Hades has only one reference. There's only one reference to Hades or one appearance by Hades in the Iliad. And all he does, the battles are raging. They're so loud and disturbing that Hades is afraid that the very surface of the earth will be disturbed and Hades will, and the underworld will be exposed. And so his reaction is to scream. He doesn't even say anything. He just screams. That is his only incarnate appearance in the Iliad. And I thought that was very curious. Here's this key god in our lives, and he barely has an appearance, even though the Iliad is a butchery. I think probably the one reason that it became a mythical war, it must have been the degree of its violence. Because after all, wars were endemic at that time. Here's one that actually was remembered and became myth, and it must have been its horrific violence. So if any god was busy and should have been all over the place, it was Hades, but he is not. And in terms of his relation to love, well, I think we, you know, the test of love is suffering. I think love is tested by suffering, and love comes from suffering. I remember I was younger when the AIDS crisis hit, and I was a standard little issue heterosexual boy, but I had friends who were gay and whose parents were gay, and I remember the degree of love that was unleashed by the AIDS crisis. These, you know, gays who were demonized for having AIDS, and yet the devotion they showed to each other. And I that was very touching to me, that from suffering you can get love, and love can overcome suffering. So I think that's the one of the things, well, that's what we hope anyway, that from suffering comes love. But I think the two are closely paralleled, hence why in my story, Hades is, it, despite being a god of the underworld and a god of death, he's suddenly intrigued by Soaz's suffering and his violence, and he wants to learn about death from him. Because after all, as a god, as you referred to gods, they're immortal, and therefore, because a god is immortal, there's a limitation to how much they can know about suffering. After all, if you're mortal, you certainly don't know physical suffering. Although there is physical suffering of gods in the Iliad, two gods are injured by Diomedes. The same mortal man injures Aphrodite by spearing her in the wrist, and by amazingly stabbing Ares in the stomach with an arrow. But that's unusual. We're not used to gods actually suffering, and Hades realizes that limitation and therefore asks Soaz, he says, teach me about death. You being mortal, teach me something I don't know about. And hence that's why he talks to Soaz. He wants to learn about that. And we presume in a sense to learn about love. Because if you can never die at one point, what does love matter? You don't really need it, do you? You have infinite life, infinite time. You know, then you dally in love the way Zeus does. But Hades has this moment of illumination and sort of suddenly realizes that maybe you, limited as you are, you may teach me something that I don't know.
Yeah, there's that beautiful moment where he wonders if, he says, mortals long to be immortal, but do immortals long for the opposite? Do they long to be mortal? Nikita, you've got a really powerful connection between love and death in your novel as well. There's a striking moment in the book when she's a young woman, Hecate disobeys Styx's very firm rules and she ventures beyond the gates of the underworld. She goes to the fields of Asphodel, to which she then regularly returns. Tell us about the significance of this place in Greek mythology, and also about what Hecate learns from it, what it teaches her about death and love.
So in the book, you know, because Hecate doesn't have her parents, they're taken from her. She doesn't know what her purpose is. She's a goddess without a purpose. She has no idea what she was made for. The gods all know at birth what they're made for. And she's unusual in that way, where she has to go and find her own purpose. And it becomes quite a key factor in the book that in her seeking, she continuously disobeys Styx, who has, like, there's literally a poem that says, you know, Styx has all of these rules, and the next page is, and I disobey every single one of them. And I loved writing that bit, because that just goes to show she's not just headstrong, she's driven. And her driving force is, what is it? And when no one else is there to teach her, she goes, well, the Asphodel meadows are right there. Maybe the spirits of the mortals have something to teach me, which is so humbling for a goddess, right? But she doesn't see it that way. She goes and she makes friends with the spirits of women, and they invite her into their circles. And what they invite her into is stories of their lives, of loves and hopes and dreams and sorrows, and, you know, the many people they have loved, from lovers and their children. And she learns all about it from them and from these stories. And that gives her this real affection for mortals and a real depth in her own love for mortals, because she sees them as, because mortals live such short lives, and there's a deleted poem which basically talks about how we are butterflies in the eyes of the universe, where there are sparks and then we are gone. For her, she says that, in many ways, mortals are so much luckier than gods, because everything they experience is at a heightened point. Their joys, their griefs, you know, and the depths of their loves are so much deeper than what we can ever have. And she says, and she calls out the gods, and she says, you know, gods see mortals as so much inferior to us. But isn't it true that their experiences are so much more vivid than we could ever have? And I love that about her. I love that she is that one goddess that goes, there is no
the difference between us is not that they are lesser, it's that they are brighter.
Eternal themes, hey, and stories that just keep coming back. It's Mythical Retellings today on Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen with me, Natasha Mitchell. The Irish Indian best-selling poet Nikita Gill, Booker Prize-winning Canadian author Yann Martel, and Australian actor and author Zoe Tarakis are joining you from the stage of the Melbourne Writers' Festival with host Carity Culver.
Zoe, there are a couple of stories in Eros that entwine love and death in such interesting ways, and I wanted to ask you about one of my favourites. So it's a super steamy retelling of the myth of Icarus. So famously, Icarus flew too close to the sun, and the original tale, I think, is a warning against hubris and ambition, possibly also the perils of not listening to your parents' advice, which is no fun at all. But in your version, Icarus is driven really not by arrogance or pride, but by really intense desire. Tell us about that and where that reinterpretation came from.
Yeah, I mean, I guess not that I never bought the other one, but that I didn't buy the other one. I just thought that, you know, Apollo is a god who is the sun, but also can be a man and takes shape as both. And of course, to feel that, I mean, we've all had that feeling of feeling the sun on us. And, you know, I mean, I'm Greek, so the sun is inherently erotic. But I think, you know, particularly for Icarus, who was, you know, because his father Daedalus was an amazing craftsman and had built the labyrinth for the Minotaur. And then King Minos tricked him and locked him in a tower with his son in Crete. And there's a window in this tower where Icarus can feel the sun on him every day. And Icarus is sort of, he's blooming, he's becoming a man, really. And he loves the sun and he lives for it. And then the sun comes to him and they have this, like, quite extraordinary love affair where the sun will visit him. But of course, because you're on God's time, so it'll feel like for Icarus 15 minutes, but it's been a whole day. And, you know, he gets a sunburnt cock after after their encounters. And, yeah, I just thought it was, because we all know that feeling so well. Not the sunburnt cock part. Not that feeling. I mean, the feeling of loving something where you know you should stop and you know this is going to end terribly, but you just can't. And playing it out till its end is better than not knowing. And I believe that is what came over Icarus when he saw the sun and he felt the wax melting, and feathers dropping as it's like, but I could just touch him and then I'd know. And obviously, you know, we know how it ends. But I just thought, yeah, there's so much hubris and arrogance and, you know, there's so many punitive systems in Greek myth. And I just thought maybe this one wasn't. Maybe it was love, actually.
Yeah, I loved it. And you've also got a really wild retelling of Orpheus and Eurydice, where again you put it becomes less a tragic story and more this kind of joyous reclamation with a very sort of Cronenberg-esque.
It's just because I hate Orpheus.
That does come across very strongly. Yeah.
That guy sucks.
He's like Romeo. He's just wet.
I've got one final crafty question for each of you, and then we're going to throw to audience questions. Yann, I love that you wrote an epic poem for this novel, and I'm very curious about how you went about that process. Did you write the poem and Harlow's narrative concurrently? Did you feel like you had to have the poem down first before you could then inhabit Harlow's reading of it? How did you go about putting the book together?
That is a craft question. So I wrote the epic first because it had to be in chronological order. So as arrives at Troy, things happen to him, his days at Troy end. So I wrote that first because I wanted that chronology. And in a sense, that's the forward part of the book. That's the epic part at the top. The little details necessarily would come later, and the little footnotes, important as they are, I have a line in the in the novel. At one point, I say we're all footnotes to a greater story. Those are essential, but they do come secondary to the great story. So, yeah, the footnotes very much came after each fragment. And the difficulties I had was when I would eliminate a fragment. I had too many fragments, so I would eliminate one. Well, I suddenly had these orphaned footnotes that needed a home, speaking of home. So I'd have to rearrange them. But what's nice about footnotes is footnotes stand quite independent of each other, because each footnote refers to something different in the text. So it wasn't too complicated to find them new homes. I just had to find a different thing that they might refer to. Some of the references are quite obvious, like I don't presume the readers read the Iliad, so I have footnotes that explain a few of the essential elements of the Trojan War. Some are, you know, more pseudo-academic. They're about the Soad, this epic. And then some are entirely personal, to do with Harlow Dunn. And it was quite pleasing the way in which I had to have the two come after each other, epic and then the footnotes. Because sometimes it's quite obvious why there's a footnote. It's very much a clarification of something. But sometimes it's much more elliptical as to why something to do with Harlow's life would have a reference in the ancient poem. That's, to me, I hope, is one of the attractions for the readers, to figure out the relationship between the two, which is how we have to figure out the relationship between the present and the past, what we make of the past, what we use of it. As I said, it's wonderfully, the myths are wonderfully plastic. We can play with them to illuminate our lives. We have to figure out, well, what is that illumination exactly? How does it apply to today? What do we make of it? So, but yeah, that was the way it went. Epic first and then the footnotes. Mm.
I love the reading process and that you get some pages that are many, 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 many pages of just the poem, some that are poem and footnote, and some that are just those notes from Harlow. Nikita, I love the way that Hecate unfolds in different types of verse. You've got lyrical, prose. I understand that you write in prose first. Tell us about that process and how you shape the narrative into a collection of poems.
I actually do just write in poetry, but I write the endings of my stories first. And because this is a trilogy, the ending of this trilogy has been written for 7 years now, 8 years. So I've worked my way backwards, basically, to the front of the story. And it's really important to me to always have a return. So in each of the books, there's a return to the beginning image. And because this came to me, all three books came to me as this very vivid Technicolor dream. And where the prose bit comes in is I tried to write Hecate in prose format. I tried, and it would stop at chapter 3. So I had to have this conversation with my agent, and she's like, if it's not coming out in prose, just write it in poetry. Do what you love doing best. And verse novels that way are both very difficult. I like calling verse the watercolor of literature because it's such an unforgiving medium. you can't have filler sentences. You can't go from, they went from here to here. Everything has to earn. The economy of language is so solid. Like, everything has to earn its place. And when you're telling a whole story in verse, it means, yeah, there's no space for, which is why my editor said, oh, I love the pace of this. I'm like, yeah, you like the pace because it goes really fast, like, because that's what verse does for you. I worked my way backwards from the ending. I found the image where I thought Hecate should end, and then made my way back to the front, the beginning image, all over again to have that return. And there's constant callbacks all through the book. But what's been really interesting is when I'm staging it as a play, putting in Easter eggs for everyone who's read the book. I love doing that for my readers, like just putting Easter eggs everywhere in the play, and they're like, ah, that's the thing there. It's great. Yeah.
Love an Easter egg. That's such an interesting process. And Zoe, I would love to know more about how you approached putting together this book. How did you decide which stories you were going to reimagine, and what was that process like?
Yeah, it ended up being, because they're all love stories, it ended up being a process of the types of love I wanted to write about, because they're all very different types of love. A good example of that is the Hermaphrodite story, which is the last one and is my favorite. That story, I wanted it in there so badly because she's so amazing. She's such an amazing goddess. But her becoming is really fraught. So for those of you who don't know, the son of Hermes and Aphrodite was walking in, you know, a field, and Salmasis, this Turkish river nymph, came up to him and said, "You're so beautiful, can I kiss you?" And he said, "No, thank you." And then he saw a river, and he went swimming in the river, not realizing it was her river, and she raped him and prayed to the gods that they be bound together forever. And that is where we get the word hermaphrodite, is you had this body that now had boobs and a penis and was a woman. And I forgot about self-love for about 6 months, and I was like, oh, I gotta make this horrible encounter some kind of love between two people. And I, you know, it really, I stopped writing for 6 months because I was like, I just can't figure out how to make this anything but what it is, which is assault. And then I remembered people love themselves. and especially after violence like that, the journey to becoming a goddess who was worshipped and loved is not linear or easy. And so that story became, it's the only one in the book where there isn't really love between two people. And I said it in The Cross in the 90s. And it's a Turkish drug dealer at, you know, an equivalent of the taxi club. And yeah, and her journey thereafter is very much about, like, how do I love a body that is something that I have always wanted but has been given to me in violence? And how do I inhabit myself, really? So yeah, that was, it was really fascinating, I guess, figuring out the different types of love I wanted to include in the book.
Yeah, and I love that you took with Hermaphroditus in particular, you take your version of the story far beyond the point at which the original myth finishes. We've got lots of great questions, so this is one for all of you. Someone has asked, how should we approach myths destroyed by colonialism that have also often only been recorded from the perspective of colonizers? Who would like to go for that one first?
I mean, I'll bite. It's pretty frustrating being Cretan and having your stories told back to you in ways that are unrecognizable, particularly when our myths are so often parroted by manosphere, right-wing fascists who have sort of stolen these stories and, I believe, stripped them of their truth. And I, you know, I do just feel like going, you all hate gay people so much. Do you know what they were up to back in ancient Greece? I'm like, I don't know if you'd be quoting this. Yeah, but I think it's really cool that we're, you know, and I'm so grateful for all the people who have adapted myths with their truth. But I think it's really awesome that we're seeing sort of a new generation of people retelling these myths who are sort of revitalizing the sex in them and the violence and the queerness and the transness. Like, I think it's really, really important that these myths aren't co-opted and also sanitized. And I think we run the risk of when, you know, specifically a lot of, you know, Anglo heterosexual people tell these stories, that when they bring the queerness to the front, there's sort of this thing that happens where then everything else gets sanitized, any violence gets stripped away. And I just reject that. I think if we're going to bring out the truth of these stories, that means the queerness and the transness and the violence. And I think it's patronizing to pretend the violence doesn't happen just because we're telling a queer story.
Nikita and Jan, do you have anything you want to add?
I was just going to say that Great Goddesses, which features characters, obviously, well, characters, archetypes, these gods, in their true form, like Apollo being gay, Artemis being gay, very gay. she asks her dad for a moon and a bevy of, you know, beautiful women. I think she's gay. So yeah, I wrote this book back in 2018, and I really enjoyed writing it. And then it hit a banned books list in Manchester. Schools started basically banning the book because they didn't like the fact that it featured gay Greek gods. And I was like,
newsflash.
Yeah. Have you read the classics? It obviously not. And I really think that's the frustrating thing as writers, is that we're not really deviating, as you said. We're not deviating from what the classics are saying, but these voices that are so influenced by,
you know, the manosphere and the hatred of queerness in any format are trying to like destroy what is historical and what is true. And that, I think, is the most frustrating wall that I keep hitting with these people. And it's just like, for God's sakes. So, yeah.
I actually read your book when I was researching for my book.
Oh. Van Gogh.
I love you so much.
It was so awesome.
Jan, anything to add?
Well, as I was saying earlier, I think the nature of myths is they're plastic, elastic. So if they've been kidnapped by one group, the solution is to take them back and retell them in the way you want. And so, in fact, it's really interesting. If you look at the Iliad, there's a lot of queer potential in it. So there's one interesting scene in where Homer describes Achilles' tent. And in vast majority of translations, Homer's heteronormative intent is very clear in the sense that you have Achilles' tent on one side of the tent and Patroclus is on the other side of the tent. And then Achilles has a beautiful girl with him and Patroclus has a beautiful girl with him. And the intent of Homer seems very clear to say that they do share the tent for whatever reason. They're not students, but whatever. But it could be for many, maybe just there was, you know, more collegial or whatever. But the intent seems very clear that they're on opposite sides of the tent. Well, it's interesting. If you read Emily Wilson's translation has done really well recently. And in her translation, the beds are side by side, and I happened to meet her in Philadelphia, and I pointed out that every other translation, the Fagel, the Mitchell, the Richmond Lattimore, the beds are on opposite sides of the tent. And she said, well, it all comes down to the ancient Greek word for the other side of. And it's not entirely clear if it's the other side of the tent or the other side of Achilles, as if he were standing and it's on the other side of him right here. So there's a space there where it could be interpreted in many, many ways. But one thing that's interesting is we all have this notion that the Greeks were very accepting of it, but it's not exactly clear in the text of the Iliad. For example, as I'm sure you all know, the Iliad is about Agamemnon's anger with Achilles, and Achilles turns his back on the Greek fighting and the Greeks start to die. And eventually Agamemnon wants to make amends. And the way he proposes to make amends is, first of all, he returns Briseis, who is described as beautiful, back to Achilles. He promises his own daughter to Achilles. And then he promises, in addition, 7 beautiful girls captured from whatever cities around there. So that's 9 young women in total. He doesn't promise 9 young men also. There's very clearly this heterosexual intent in there. But clearly, Achilles returns to the battle because Patroclus is killed. And why would he do that but for some love towards him that would be beyond just the love of a friend? So there's a lot of space there to take that myth back and explain it in different ways. And that's what I find is really, as I said earlier, because there's no accountability. There's no one owns these myths. You can do what you want with them. One thing that's always charmed me is, you know, it's a more, much more modern myth, the very known one by everyone, Little Red Riding Hood. Little Red Riding Hood, in the actual original telling of Little Red Riding Hood, Little Red Riding Hood gets her head, literally gets her head bitten off by the wolf. There is no redemption for Little Red Riding Hood in the original telling. Well, very clearly, quickly, that did not satisfy everyone. So what did they do? They reapproached him and said, no, let's bring in this hunter who will slice open the wolf and save the grandmother, and Little Red Riding will not be endangered. But see, there's a perfect example. If you do of myth what you want, so the assholes will do stupid things with them, well, then just ignore them and take the same myth, take repossession of it, and tell your own story, because that's what they're great for. They're very plastic. You can do what you want with them. As much with the Iliad as with Little Red Riding or any other myths you want out there.
A fantastic lesson. I always felt bad for the wolf in Little Red Riding Hood. One final quickfire round. Another question for all of you. With the writing of Present Company excluded, what is your top recommendation of a mythical retelling? Nikita, you look
so
like you're
many.
Raring to go.
Okay, so No Friend to This House by Natalie Haynes. Please read that. It's a retelling of Medea's myth. And it features this phenomenal scene where Medea sees Jason for the first time, thinks that he's beautiful, and panics and screams because she's like, oh God, I'm going to be in love with this man. And I genuinely, please read that book. It's so, so good. So yeah, that's one of my many.
I love Eurydice, Sarah Rule's play, which really informed my telling of Eurydice. It's just, there's something so bleak and stripped back about it. And when Eurydice gets to hell, Orpheus sends her letters by putting them in the mouth of a worm, and a worm scooches them down to hell. And then this 7-year-old boy comes up on a like little tricycle thing, and she says, "Who are you?" And he says, "I'm Hades." And then she says, "How am I supposed to know you're Hades?" And he says, "I can do push-ups in your bones." And then she says, "Prove it." Like, it's the most amazing, sparse telling of this myth. Yeah, I think she's extraordinary.
Jan, what about you?
Not a Greek myth. The first one that came to my mind was a retelling of Gilgamesh, an even older myth, by a Canadian poet, as it happens, but he lives in England, named Derek Hines. He did a phenomenal retelling of Gilgamesh, which is a much spare, much shorter poem about mortality, about death and what it means and the terror of it and this quest for immortality. Derek Hines, it's a wonderful retelling of the Epic of Gilgamesh.
A wonderful note to end on. We are out of time, but please put your hands together for Zoe, Nikita and Jan.
Well, that's your reading list sorted. You heard from Canadian author Jan Martel. You know him for Life of Pi. His new book is called Son of Nobody. Irish Indian poet Nikita Gill, who's written Hecate, The Witch, and Zoe Tarakis. Their book is Eros, all taking on Greek mythology in new ways from modern readers. The host was Carity Culver from Griffith Review. And our thanks to the Melbourne Writers Festival for that terrific discussion, which I was in the audience for, actually. I found it completely compelling. Hey, next on Big Ideas, censorship, controversy, political pressure, mass boycotts, festivals collapsing. The arts has seen it all in Australia recently. So how free should artists be to make risky work, to provoke, to get political? And who gets to decide if a work of art is too risky, too dangerous, too difficult? Yeah, you can join me for an event on the future of artistic freedom and democracy in Australia that I hosted at Griffith University. That's up next. Our email, bigideas@abc.net.au. And I'll catch you next time for more Big Ideas.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.